Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hazing and the culture of competitive marching bands. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, a scandal is unfolding at Florida A&M University, where 11 marching band members are facing felony charges in the death of a drum major last year. We'll look at the role that hazing plays in some campus bands. For more than 60 years, musicians seeking inspiration have turned to a collection of scales known as Slonimsky's Thesaurus. Among the latest to consult it, indie rockers like Andrew Bird, Lee Ranaldo, and this singer-songwriter, Cat Martino. They're all part of a new CD project, and Cat Martino will play a song live in our studio. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. It's the magic of podcasting. We're skipping the news, but I do want to encourage you to connect with us via social media. You'll get updates when we post new interviews, videos of in-studio performances, and I'll share more of my thoughts from the Soundcheck blog. You'll find us on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org, also on Facebook and on Twitter, at Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on our show today, how a 60-year-old book of scales is still inspiring new music today. And we'll have a live performance from New York singer-songwriter Cat Martino. But we'll begin with a disturbing story that's been making headlines since last fall. Normally, when we think of hazing, we associate it with fraternities or the military. But on November 19th of last year, a Florida A&M University drum major named Robert Champion died after being severely beaten in a marching band hazing ritual. Earlier this month, 11 of the 26-year-old's bandmates were charged with felony hazing. And this week, the president of Florida A&M announced that the band would remain suspended for at least another year. Joining me on the line from Atlanta, Georgia, is ESPN investigative reporter Mike Fish. He wrote a long piece about the band and this incident earlier this month and joins us on Soundcheck. Mike, welcome.
Hey, thank you. How are you doing today?
Good. Can you put this into context for people who haven't heard of the Florida A&M University band? Who are they? How important are they?
Well, the Florida A&M Marching 100, as they're called, is probably one of the top bands in the country. They performed at the Grammys. They performed the two presidential inauguration parades, both with President Obama and with President Clinton's second inauguration parade. They performed at three of the last Super Bowls, I believe. They are more popular on the Florida A&M campus in Tallahassee, Florida, than the football team is. So, I mean, it's extremely important. They're a very prominent factor in the college community there.
So the fact that they've been suspended and remain suspended for at least another year, this we're talking about a serious amount of money that's at stake here.
Yeah, we are. It's a little bit, let me backtrack a little bit. People have said they've been suspended, and they have been, but they were suspended in late November, the 1st of December or so, which is actually after the football season had concluded. So really they haven't missed a whole lot during that suspension.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is they'll be suspended next year, which again obviously includes the full football season. And it's important because the football team is basically it's a 1AA program. It's just below the major programs.
Right.
And what happens is a lot of schools, for instance, last year they played at South Florida. They played at Miami. This year they're playing at Oklahoma, and when they get those contracts to appear, and again, unfortunately, I don't have the contracts in front of me, but they might be for $500,000 or something like that, and those are huge payoffs for Florida A&M. But part of the requirement is that the band show up with the football team, because, again, the band is so popular, and it is an attraction, particularly in Miami and in Tampa when they're playing South Florida, and that raises questions in terms of how they're going to deal with those contracts going forward.
Now, this we should also mention Florida A&M is a so-called HBC, historically
right.
Black college, a la Grambling or Alcorn State.
You got Southern, you got...
Yeah. So now the band, as you say, on campus, even more prestigious than the football team itself, The hazing incident happened in the wake of the 2011 Florida Classic. This is the big football game of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the season-ending game, and it's held every year, and it's held in Orlando. And it's probably about a five—I didn't realize this until I started reporting on this. I assumed it was like a weekend deal. But it's actually about 4 or 5 days, I guess. And there's all sorts of alumni events. There's concerts that go along with that. There's, you know, social gatherings and all sorts of things like that that, you know, are a huge draw for alumni and fans of the university and fans of the football team and people just looking for a social event to, you know, gravitate towards.
Well, this was the sound of the famed Marching 100, Florida A&M University's marching band, at the halftime performance of the Florida Classic. From November 19th, 2011, the so-called Florida Classic. That was Florida A&M's Marching 100. That was the last performance that drum major Robert Champion took part in. The performance took place the day of his death in a hazing incident aboard a bus. And we're speaking with Mike Fish, ESPN investigative reporter. You can find his story about Robert Champion's death on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Mike, in reporting this, how deeply ingrained is hazing in the culture of this band and, by extension, perhaps other marching bands in that area?
I think it's deeply ingrained. I think if you look at the historically black universities, the bands, there's huge competitions. We mentioned, we're talking about the Florida Classic in Orlando. Well, that's Florida A&M and it's Bethune-Cookman. And it's every year, every, you know, late November, whatever. But those bands, as much as the football teams, are in competition during those halftime performances and performances after the game. What, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but that band halftime performance went long. And I'm not sure what was said, but the PA person with the Bethune-Cookman band made some derogatory sexual comment about the Florida A&M band. Mm. And that created a brouhaha, and, you know, Bethune-Cookman had to respond to it and whatnot in the days that would follow. But it's extraordinarily deep ingrained, and we're talking about the hazing culture. Within the band, there are what you'd call almost subcultures. Each instrument section has this little culture or a group that has a name attached to it. And if you're a trombone player, a tuba player, whatever, a saxophone, percussionist, if you want to be within the hierarchy of the band to be respected, you typically want to join one of those subcultures or sections. And that's where the hazing occurs. And typically it's off campus in a student's apartment at somebody's house. Obviously it's not done on the practice field per se.
Mm-hmm. But then this particular incident happened aboard a bus, and it happened to a drum major. Now, you know, so what are the kind of internal politics that were at work here?
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit. The drum major in the Florida A&M marching band is the equivalent, I've explained this to people, of a college football quarterback.
Right.
I mean, he's a big man on campus. Socially, he's got a lot of things going for him. In this band, this past season, they had 6 drum majors. There's 1 head drum major and 5, you know, drum majors. And that's actually a small number. I've heard that at times they've had as many as, you know, 9 or 10 or something like that. But these guys basically are their liaisons for the, you know, band director. They're his go-to guys. They help run the practices, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, a great deal of credibility within that band. The question that you're raising, I think you're suggesting, is why on earth would a drum major who is
right
in a prestigious position put himself in a situation where he's being hazed? I don't know if you want to interject or ask some questions, but I can go on and explain.
Well,
that is
exactly what the question I was asking.
Okay.
You. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me set the scene for you a little bit. On this bus, there's probably, for my reporting, probably 25 to 30 people. And subsequently, the folks who have been charged, we've seen that there are three drum majors who were charged, okay, with third-degree felony hazing. So three drum majors are allegedly, you know, involved with Robert Champion's death. With Robert Champion that day crossing this bus, the ceremony or the ritual is called Crossing Bus C. You start in the front of the bus. You're basically, you know, prepped, they call it. You'll take your T-shirt off. They'll slap you in the chest, slap you in the back. You know, don't touch your face, but they'll rough you up a little bit. Then you got to go from the front of the bus to the back of the bus.
Right.
And in the process, you've got to pass through all these people. And the bus aisle, as you can imagine, is probably, what, maybe a yard wide?
Mm-hmm, right.
As you can imagine, in a coach bus, it's not real wide, if you will.
Well, Mike, let me. I mean, as long as you're going to take us down this road, let me actually play a clip from the ESPN story in which band member Keon Hollis, who went with Robert Champion on the bus and went through the same ritual, describes what they went through with this so-called crossing bus C.
I saw him beating him. I saw him punching him, kicking him. Saw him hitting them with stuff. I saw them hold them down so they can beat them some more. I saw them pull them back. He got about halfway, then pulled him back a couple more feet.
How far did he get?
He made it to the back. He finished. He just looked at me like we both was feeling the same way, just out of it. And I remember he asked me for something to drink. And then after that, I got off the bus and I left. I walked back to the room. And that was the last time that I talked to him.
Now, that is Keon Hollis, another member of the Florida A&M University Marching 100, talking to your colleague, Mike, T.J. Quinn there.
Right. Now, it's also important, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's also important to note that Keon Hollis is also a drum major. So the point I was getting to before, and I apologize for taking so long to get there, you had three drum majors who are accused of partaking in beating these guys. You had Robert Champion, who was a drum major. Keon Hollis was also a drum major. So you had two drum majors going through this ritual. So five of the six drum majors were on that bus that night. Now, the reason why it's ranged from people saying that Robert Champion didn't have respect to the band or full respect to the band because he had apparently been anti-hazing and had taken some grief from that. There's also an issue been raised about his sexuality and whether or not that played into the fact he's openly gay. And people were suggesting because of that he was treated differently and harsher and beaten worse. Although in talking to people, there's very much mixed opinions on whether or not that's the case.
Right. And there are many other incidents going back to 1998 that would suggest that this was not all that unusual. We've got two incidents of kidney failure. Last fall, a female freshman suffered a blood clot in her leg and a cracked femur. Three people were charged in that incident. She's currently suing the university. Where is the band director in all of this?
Well, he's no longer the band director.
Yeah, but he retired. I mean, he was.
Yeah, I was being facetious, so I apologize. No, he's an older gentleman. He's been with the university both as a student, as a drum major, as a professor, and now is the band director for almost 50 years. We spoke to him. He basically denied any knowledge of this bus C ritual. Didn't know it even happened. Didn't know this thing existed. He had a vague recollection of some of these subcultures and some of the hazing stuff that went on. He thought he had things under control. Obviously, they didn't have things under control. It's, you know, blatantly obvious. The other thing that's come out in recent weeks, I guess in the last month or so, is that two people who were instructors within the band, who were professors in a music department, they had allowed some rituals to happen at this one professor's house, and both of these professors apparently witnessed the hazing rituals take place at the professor's house. So they both have since stepped down and resigned in the wake of likely being fired.
Wow. Now, Mike, one other question. It occurs to me, we're talking about the death of a 26-year-old man, Robert Champion. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at some of the other ages of the people involved. We're not necessarily talking about 18, 19, 20-year-olds, but people who are of an age where you might expect them to be beyond college. How many of these people are actually students at the university?
Well, that's one of the more startling things that we stumbled upon is when you look at that, you're right. You have young men who are 26 years old, 23, 24, 25. There's two things at play here. One is that, you know, some of these kids start school and they leave or come back or they're going part-time. And the other issue is that the band is very much a social scene, and it's something people gravitate towards and in a lot of cases don't want to leave because it is it's a popular scene. It's a good place to be at in their lives. So they hang around for what seems like forever. And what subsequently come out is that a fair number of these people who were in the band are actually not students. They were not. They may have been enrolled at the start of the year, but when this incident happened in November, they were no longer students. And I believe the number is probably about 100.
Yeah.
So 100 of 300-plus people in the band, or a third of them, were not full-time students or registered as students when this incident happened.
And the incident, again, that we are discussing is the death of drum major Robert Champion. He was with the Florida A&M University's band, the famed Marching 100, Marching 100s. And Mike Fish, ESPN investigative reporter, you can find his story on the death on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Mike, thanks very much for being with us on Soundcheck.
You. Okay, take
and
care
this is more from that November 19th performance, that halftime performance at the annual Florida Classic by the band. Florida A&M Marching 100. Joining me now on the line from Durham, North Carolina, is Joram Reed. He is currently director of the North Carolina Central University Sound Machine, their marching band, and he is a former undergraduate drum major at Florida A&M University. Joram, thanks for being with us today on Soundcheck.
All right, thank you.
Tell me, first of all, you know, Mike Fish got a little bit into this, but a drum major, what is the role of the drum major in this context?
I think he was accurate by stating that a drum major is the quarterback, the leader of the band.
Yeah, what confused me about that is, you know, every football fan, knows that a team with more than one quarterback is a team with a problem. You know, usually there's one quarterback, you don't want a quarterback controversy. How does it work with, like, a band with six drum majors? It's like having six conductors.
That's a collaborative effort or work, or you can liken, if you use the football analogy, when the captains of the team go out for the coin toss.
Okay. And is it important for the drum majors to have, you know, kind of the respect of the rank-and-file musicians?
You would want, of course you would definitely want the respect of your peers.
Mm-hmm.
In any situation.
Are they peers, or are you sort of, as a drum major, kind of in a position of authority?
As a drum major, you're just as you would be a football captain. You're going to be in a locker room, and your locker may be next to someone who's not a captain.
Right. So do you understand why Robert Champion, himself a drum major, and Keon Hollis, who went with him on this hazing ritual, do you understand why these guys would have put themselves through a ritual like this?
I honestly have been totally confused. I really do not have the answers to that. Only a qualified psychologist, counselor, you know, that can look into the psyche or mindset, look at every single aspect of the situation, could answer that. I couldn't. I really could not answer that. I've wanted the answers myself.
Yeah. Have you, when you were at Florida A&M, when you were in the band, were you aware of hazing?
It happened, and it's documented that it happened, but I think the thing that I would say disturbs me the most is that everyone that participated in that band did not haze or got haze. Did it happen? Yes. And, you know, everyone, you know, really did not subject themselves or, you know, participate in that criminal behavior. And it's kind of one of those situations where, since, you know, I'm a big football fan, if you liken the Dallas Cowboys, where you have a couple of your star players acting badly, the whole team gets marred.
Right. And so what about, you know, the director, Julian White? I mean, Mike mentioned that he's been the director at Florida A&M, the band director there for about half a century. What was his I mean, was he a vocal, you know, proponent of anti-hazing measures? What was the sort of the culture like there?
In Mike's article, he actually had the documentation where students were consistently arrested over the years and put mm-hmm. out. I recall, even reading about students getting arrested and some of the other matters that have taken place, and he really was the spearhead of making the decision and putting people out of the band.
Julian White, the director.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And actually, at the time I was in school, he was the associate director. So he was really, I think there was a missive that's on Mike Fish's site that's a PDF that Dr. White wrote in 1990. Mm-hmm. And I think it was addressed to the then director of bands, Dr. William P. Foster, about the issue of hazing and wanting to deal with it then. And he was the associate director at the time. So he was always adamant about eradicating that behavior.
Well, it sounds like there's, you know, at least on paper, a trail of people saying the right thing. And yet, as you say, you know, there's been this kind of litany of incidents and arrests and injuries and now a death. You know, it's such a... Does it give band culture or perhaps bands specifically within the historically black colleges, giving everybody a bad rap?
Yes, I think. I really do. I believe so, because this is an issue that's not just with historically black college and mm-hmm. university band programs. I mean, this is something, you know, we keep using this word culture, and I agree, but there's another word that I would like to see being used would be the human condition. In any type of environment where you have people involved, let's say at NPR, if mm-hmm. someone's new and then all of a sudden they decide that you have to go get the paper clips, you have to go collect the cables, and then, of course, when ones get promoted and then you come back 20 years from now, then you find out that there's some horseplay for something just so someone can get a new stapler. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that is a great enigma in trying to find out why.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of solutions, possibly, but trying to figure out why, for me, has always been an enigma.
Well, Joram, you're now in a position where, you know, having been a drum major at Florida A&M, you're now directing a band yourself there at North Carolina Central University. Has this incident kind of put you on guard? I mean, are you doubly vigilant? And if so, what does that mean? What can you even do? If it's the human condition, what can you do?
Definitely vigilant. And how I feel, I kind of think of something I read from you where you mentioned that music and poetry has always been closely linked,
right.
But it's always been, you know, a happy coupling. Well, I really believe that music and any type of hazing or harassment of any sort are not closely linked, and this coupling only creates cacophony. And what that means is it's about music.
Mm-hmm.
And anything other than that takes away or pollutes that. You know, I mean, if I were to look at it selfishly, an injury to a student would not allow them to play their instrument.
Of course. I want to read you a comment from one of our listeners who lists his or her name just as M. I was in a high school marching band once upon a time, and your guest described the situation very well of the subcultures within the band. It was very much a social scene. Every rank was different. There was definitely hazing within the framework of the ranks, which was more or less ritualized. I was subjected to it, too. Again, this was in the context of a high school, and this was also in a different town's demographic. The students were from diverse backgrounds, but mostly white. So we're talking about Florida A&M's band, you know, a specific band, a specific university, but it seems like, you know, this is a kind of a wider problem. And as you say, Joram, one that's kind of pernicious and hard to deal with and hard to root out. So all I can say is best of luck to you in, you know, being vigilant there at North Carolina Central.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Okay.
Joram Reed is director of the North Carolina Central University Sound Machine, their marching band. Formerly, he was an undergraduate drum major at Florida A&M University. And once again, the death last fall of Florida A&M University drum major Robert Champion, now resulting in felony charges against 11 of the 26-year-old's bandmates at Florida A&M. That is the North Carolina Central University Sound Machine Band in the background. And up next, some live music in the Soundcheck studio from singer and songwriter Kat Martino. And we'll hear about a musical dictionary from 1947 and why it's inspired musicians from the legendary jazz sax player John Coltrane to Sonic Youth guitarist Lee Ranaldo. This is Soundcheck.
Did you think I'd love you forever? And then you tell me, boy, we can do much more. Boy, we can do much
more. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I'm the first guy to admit that my job is pretty great. I get to listen to a lot of music, get to talk on the radio, I get unlimited use of the Soundcheck Action News Chopper on weekends and holidays. But there's another benefit to a job like this. You meet a lot of musicians. You invite one in, and they bring someone else. Like when Sufjan Stevens joined us to perform this song on the show last year. He brought a band that included the singer Kat Martino. Now we've asked Kat back to talk about a project inspired by a kind of dictionary of scales. But first, let's get to meet her, and we'll hear one of her original songs in a live performance. Kat, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks.
So you were here last summer with Sufjan Stevens. You've also played with Sharon Van Etten. How long have you been making your own music and writing your own songs?
I guess since I was about 3 years old.
Really?
No. I mean, I don't think some of those early ones really count. But
so it's just something you've done all along as you've been growing up? And.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I think I started to more think about songwriting when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how sort of theoretical is the process of writing? I mean, do you sit down and say, I want this song to be in D minor and I want it to have like lots of seventh chords, or does it just happen?
Yeah, I usually turn off my thinking brain when I'm writing and it's pretty intuitive and stream of consciousness. And rarely before this project that we're going to talk about have I really purposefully come at it from that standpoint.
All right, well, but you did have the opportunity to come at a song from that standpoint.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Right.
But at the moment, you're seated at our piano with like a rack of stuff nearby.
Yeah.
So what is this setup you're about to employ?
Well, I have a looping pedal, and it allows me to create live samples with my voice and instruments, and I have a little Casio SK-1, and...
Don't we all?
I happen to bring a Steinway piano, grand piano with me today.
Very nice. you're walking out of here with one of those keyboards, but it ain't going to be the Steinway, Kat.
Darn.
So you want to do the title track from your next record?
Sure.
All right, the song is called You're Not Alone. That's your Y-R. You're Not Alone. It's Kat Martino doing singing, live looping, and playing the keyboards here in the Soundcheck studio.
Thanks. Okay.
Just
a strange and funny bird. Ooh. You came inside, bought me a drink, you stopped my song with what do you think? You twitched your body, flashed those pearls like Charlie Chaplin with no words.
That is Cat Martino. Actually, a whole lot of Cat Martinos. Live in the studio, doing some live looping, playing the piano, the little SK-1 back in the 80s for $30. You could get yourself a little sampler synthesizer thing.
And
Cat's got one. So stay with us, Cat, because we're going to talk about this this kind of songwriting Book of Scales project. Cat Martino, the song was called You're Not Alone. It'll be the title track of her next album, which is due later this year. And in a moment, we'll be listening to a little bit of a song that she recorded for a project inspired by a 1947 book of musical scales as we find out about Slonimsky's Thesaurus. Stay with us on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 1947, the composer Nicholas Leninsky published a book called The Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns. Affectionately known as Leninsky's Thesaurus, the book has helped musicians, especially improvising musicians, grease the wheels of their imaginations. Among its many fans, jazz legend John Coltrane, composer Aaron Copland, and this guy, our recent guest, Andrew Bird. You're hearing a recording that Bird recently made as part of a tribute to Leninsky's Thesaurus, sponsored by Esopus Magazine. And that brings Esopus editor Todd Lippy to our studio, where he joins Kat Martino, who has a song on the project as well. Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
So Leninsky's daughter, Elektra, writes a beautiful introduction to the article on the Leninsky thing in your magazine, in which she calls it utterly stupefying to the non-musician.
And to me as well.
I know some musicians who could be kind of stupefied by Kat's raising her hand.
Knowing laughter.
What is this thing?
It was written in 1947. It took him, I think, 7 years to create. And apparently he had this urge. For your listeners who know about him, I don't have to go into too much detail, but he was this famous musicologist, lexicographer, composer, conductor, you name it, essentially.
For many years, the Bible of classical composers and musicians was a book called Bakers.
Right.
And he was the guy who—he was the editor of that.
Exactly. Huge champion of new music, contemporary avant-garde music.
And the most polysyllabic English I have ever read anywhere. And it was like his third or fourth language.
Exactly. So he wrote this book, and he wanted to create basically this compendium of every possible musical scale and melodic pattern. So I think he had a particular, there's a whole chapter in his autobiography called Perfect Pitch, which is basically goes through the methodology behind it. But I honestly read it and I have no idea what he was talking about. But
read his autobiography.
The autobiography was fantastic. He's a great writer and very funny.
Did you read his review of his autobiography?
Yes, which was fantastic.
He actually reviewed his own autobiography. The guy was amazing. Died at the age of 101 and lived every one of those 101 years.
Exactly.
We're talking about Nicholas Leninsky and his thesaurus of 244 pages of scales and melodic patterns. Did he think anybody was going to buy this thing?
Well, he was a little bit jokey about it when somebody asked him. He said, I think 17 people will buy this because only 17 people care enough and have the money, the $20 or whatever it was, $10 bucks at the time to spend on it. But, of course, it went on to be this hugely influential, you know, compendium of musical scales and patterns.
Coltrane and Copland.
Yeah, you know, Zappa and
Frank Zappa.
Everybody, you name it. It was incredible.
Kat, when they came to you and said, we have this book of scales, we'd like you to pick one and write it. First of all, did you know this thing existed?
No, I did not.
And when you opened it?
When I accepted, I was more familiar with some of the past challenges, which were, my friend Alexander Marvar had said, yeah, some of the past challenges are write about a lucid dream or a memory you had or something like that. And I got the invite from Todd and I was really excited about it. But once I opened the book, I was pretty overwhelmed. I was like, why couldn't I have gotten lucid dreaming? But that was my first reaction. But, you know, when it was all said and done, it was definitely one of the coolest songwriting projects I've ever done.
Well, now, you told us a few minutes ago that you kind of shut off the logical, the thinking part of your brain and just let the creative part work, usually, when you're writing music. So how different was the process of writing this song?
It was very different, but I did employ both techniques. So I guess I started with, I guess I call it the thinking and the non-thinking brain, which is, you know, the intuitive over the logical. So I started with really looking at the book like a scientist or, you know, or a music theorist.
And you chose scale number 1065.
I did. And that...
because the first 1064 just weren't doing it for you.
That was a very intuitive choice, actually, because I started to go through and flip pages and every scale sounded like... wah, 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 wah. It's very atonal and strange. And then when I hit 1162 and I was just playing it on my Wurlitzer...
1065.
Oh, 1065. You know.
It was 1162 was the second choice.
Okay. Yeah, I used a couple different.
You did, actually. You used two.
When I hit that scale, the first scale, it just felt right in my body.
It's a very unusual scale. It goes C, D, E flat, F sharp. So there's a big jump there, and then G, A, B, C. Yeah. That is the scale that Kat has used in creating this song, which she did for Esopus magazine and the CD that comes with this issue that looks at Slonimsky's Thesaurus. The song is called Radial Brief. Just a little bit of Kat Martino's song Radial Brief. It appears on the CD that comes with Esopus Volume 18, Edition 18.
That's right.
And we are speaking about what's going on in that edition of Esopus with the magazine's editor, Todd Lippi, and with Kat Martino, both of whom are with me in the soundcheck studio, and talking about Slonimsky's Thesaurus. So this scale, Kat, I mean, we all, sitting here, all had like the same almost physical reaction when you hear that unexpected change in harmony because of the weird jump in this scale form.
Yeah, so that's beautiful.
It really colors the song.
Yeah.
And I
would have never thought of that on my own, and which is, it made me rethink all those music theory classes that I took that I thought couldn't inform songwriting for me.
So Todd, why would you and Esopus want to do this project?
Well, yeah, we do. In every issue, we do a theme CD. And we've done, as Kat mentioned, we've done crazy things like subscribers, imaginary friends when they were kids, to spam emails, to missed connections ads on Craigslist. And Elektra, I was at a launch party of one of our issues, and Richard Castellanets, the artist, came up and said,
Sound artist.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know who Elektra York's father is? And I said, no, I have no idea. He said, Nicholas Slonimsky. And I said, well, I have no idea that is either, actually. But I got to talking to Elektra, who was a neighbor of mine, and we decided to do something in the magazine related to his guest book that he kept for years and years with all these amazing musical notations by Shostakovich and Copland and David Diamond and everybody else.
Not just musical notations, but like, thanks for the meal.
Exactly, exactly. And thanks for supporting my music when everybody said it was crap. I think that's what David Diamond says. We decided to do that. And then I started to think what the CD theme was going to be. And it just suddenly hit me that this is the perfect inspiration for musicians. And I thought it would be nice to do not just contemporary composers, you might be more familiar with this stuff, but also people like Kat and Willie Mason and Horse Feathers and bands that don't really are more singer-songwriter types.
Right. And also classical composers, contemporary ones like Richard Einhorn, been on our show a couple of times. He used scale number 1142, which is a somewhat different version of the familiar pentatonic scale, to create a piece called simply Etude for Piano Pentatonics.
Thank you.
Also on the CD that accompanies Sopus, Edition 18, this music from Richard Einhorn. The Portland, Oregon-based duo known as Horse Feathers took inspiration from another melodic pattern in Slonimsky's Thesaurus. Pattern number 377 is a series of arpeggiated, altered seventh chords, and here's what they created. That's Horse Feathers' contribution to this CD project based on the scales in Slonimsky's Thesaurus. That song's called New Munitions. The sampling artist and electronic music pioneer Carl Stone contributed this piece called Labels Table, which is based on scale number 826, which defies my power to describe anyway. Here's the song. Label's Table is from Carl Stone. So now all of those pieces of music based on scales and melodic patterns that come from Nicholas Slonimsky's 1947 book, Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns, the subject of the magazine and its accompanying CD, Sopus Edition 18. And once again, joining me in the studio, the singer-songwriter Kat Martino and Todd Lippe, the editor of Sopus. Todd, what have all of these musicians, what's the feedback been?
Everybody was so excited. It was sort of two schools. It was the school of the Richard Einhorns of the world who said, I love Slonimsky. I have the book. You don't have to send me one. You know, he's a huge inspiration for
me.
Is
the book still in print?
The book is still in print. Mm-hmm. So we sent a copy to everybody who was invited. You know, Kat hadn't heard of Slonimsky. Willie Mason, I have a quote from him somewhere here where he said, you know, this has been hugely influential to me and I'm going to use it again and again and again in my work. Absolutely. So I think it was a very strong hook, mm-hmm. I think, for musicians to enter into this world and create something from what Slonimsky had already created himself.
Nobody came back to you and said, here's the song, don't ever ask me to do anything for you again.
No, but Kat wasn't the only one who said, I thought it was going to be something a little more, you know,
yeah,
approachable.
I was so grateful. And it was actually easier than I thought it was when I started writing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's nothing more intimidating than that blank page, right? So to have...
Well,
although this is pretty intimidating.
2,000 scales of not blank is really intimidating. But
so are you going to follow Willie Mason down that path of like going back to this book and using some more of these scales later
on? Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, it's forever sort of changed how I think about songwriting, actually, mm-hmm. and I'm really grateful for that. Yeah.
So what do you think Slonimsky would make of a project like this?
I think he would love it. I mean, you know, Elektra was very pleased, and she's sort of his, you know, proxy. But she seemed to be very pleased with how it turned out. And I think my guess from what I've learned of him through her is that he would love the idea, and he would probably love the results. I think he was so into promoting new music and mm-hmm. provoking musicians and composers to think in new ways that I think he probably would have been pleased.
The edition 18 of the magazine Sopus includes the CD with all of the music that we've been talking about and hearing clips of, and there are all of these pages from his guest book. Uh-huh. As his daughter writes, you know, his wife really made him a social creature,
exactly.
Which he might otherwise not have been. But all of these amazing, like, drawings and notes from composers famous and lesser known. Esopus Edition 18, and we've been speaking with Esopus's editor, Todd Lippi, and with Kat Martino, the New York-based singer-songwriter who contributed to the project. And thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Fantastic.
Another contributor to the project, recent Soundcheck guest and Sonic Youth guitarist Lee Rinaldo, who contributed this piece called Sesquitone, 1/4. From Lee Rinaldo there in this project inspired by Nicholas Slonimsky's 1947 Thesaurus of Scales and Musical Patterns. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, we record today's musicians with yesterday's technology. A group called the 78 Project brings a genuine 1930s Presto disc recorder to our studio, and they will record the singer-songwriter Justin Townes Earle as he plays live in our studio. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. The Icelandic band Sigur Rós is set to release a new album called Valtari in a couple of weeks, but you can hear it in advance, streaming live tomorrow evening on the Soundcheck webpage. That's the new album from Sigur Rós, streaming once and once only, tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. Eastern. Go to wnyc.org/soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn with Margaret Bresnahan. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.